Blog Talk Radio.
Taking place in the city of Richmond, Virginia. It's an issue that's going on that is now catching the eyes and attention of the rest of the country. I'm quite sure with this issue, it has implications on this whole outlook of how people view African people, its history, and the value of their contribution. And the issue that we're going to be discussing today is the issue of protecting African sacred grounds versus economic development. In this case, there's a proposal by the city mayor of Richmond, Virginia, from my understanding that they'd like to do some economic development, and part of that development is to create a stadium over sacred African ground. And what this issue involves is a dynamic of what you have, the masses of maybe African people in terms of their interests and aspirations versus the interests of the small and a few corporate America. That's one generalization how people can sort of summarize this particular struggle. But to give us a more accurate assessment on this issue, there's a young lady, Sister Monica Esperanza. She's been working with this issue for, I guess, several years or so. And she will give her perspectives, and other people will be calling in, weighing in on this issue. And we'll be talking about other current events. But right now, we have with us Sister Monica. We'd like to welcome you to Africa on the Move.
Thank you very much. Welcome. For the invitation, Mr. Lane.
Okay, Sister Monica, in general, normally what we do with our audience, can you just give our audience a backdrop a little bit in terms of who you are the nature of the work that you are doing in the city of Richmond?
Well, my name, again, is Monica Esparza. I am the operator of Afro City Tours, which was founded in 2012 expressly for the purpose of helping the community, the diverse community, understand the significance of the African-American history in Shaco Bottom. We often think of Shaco Bottom in terms of just its slave history, but there's actually a very significant African and African-American history that is not talked about enough. And so that was the purpose for me of starting the company. I'm also a member of the African Ancestral Chamber, which was formed as an outgrowth of similar work and the community's interest to preserve the legacy of African ancestors. And we collectively have been at the burial ground insisting with interpretive efforts to make sure that the story is told, to make sure that the value of African-American legacy and life is told. Our immediate interest is to talk about our past and to honor our past, but in a way that is worthwhile for our present and lays foundation for our future. And so the...
No, finish. I didn't mean to cut across. Finish your thoughts.
Well, I was just going to say, and so in recent, you know, though the initiative to develop Shaco Bottom in an economic way, of course, is not new. The interest to put a baseball stadium there is not new. But we, as a collective, I'm speaking in terms of the African and Social Chamber and myself, we are present in sharing the ideal that the that the grounds of Shaco Bottom belong to the history of enslavement, and so that there should not be a stadium in Shaco Bottom.
Okay.
And also sure. The fact that... go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, go finish your point. I didn't mean to cut across. Go ahead.
No, I'll go ahead, I'm done.
Yeah, okay. No, so I'm trying to, in terms of the listening audience who are listening to this issue, they want to know what makes this issue so special in terms of the kind of attention that it has been been receiving for the last, at least a couple months now. What is really the crux of the issue? In terms of why this has become so contentious between the people
and the
male.
The question of the issue is that there's an economic development interest. And so the question is, what is it that will generate income for the city, A? And how should that income be generated? So the plan, there several plans floating in terms of you know, how to achieve that. Certainly there's a great public interest for jobs. The public, and this is just my understanding and listening to the public forum about this issue, the public is concerned about jobs. How are jobs created and what is the best avenue to create those jobs. So that's, you know, that's a core issue. We feel that there can be economic development in the same way that a stadium may be in place, that there could be economic development in the same kind of way, the same kind of economic development thrust.
Okay. Now, let me raise this question with you. I hear a lot of people talk about the interest of building in that area. And according to recently, we was privileged to speak with the mayor. And one of the things the mayor stated that he has a plan where they can develop in that area while messing with the areas that people are concerned about. What is your response to that position that the mayor has recently shared with the community?
You repeat that again, please?
The mayor has stated that they can do economic development there in the area without affecting the sacred grounds of the areas that want to be that many people want to protect the most, as relates to the history of African people.
Well, I think that
they have
the public
that can do that.
Well, I think the plan is to is focused on one historic site, and that's Lumpkin Shoal. Maybe focused also on the African burial ground. So without hearing that conversation, I hear that the African burial ground is a sacred site. I am not hearing that the 100 auction houses that are in Chaco Bottom are not considered sacred ground. And so that would be my response. What, when you say sacred ground, what are you referring to? Are you referring to specifically the African burial ground? Or are you referring to the 100 auction houses and road infrastructure that may be intact under Chaco Bottom? Are you referring to that area as well? Because if you're referring to that area, then in order to pursue economic development, the first thing that should be done is archaeological assessment to determine what is there. When they did the archaeological assessment on the one historic site, which was Lumpkin's Dale, they found over 16,000 artifacts, that is my understanding. So if that's at one site, can you imagine what they may find for 100 sites? That time or resources, to my understanding, has not been allocated as yet to do that kind of research. And so my interest in preserving Chaco Bottom is so that there would be an opportunity to do that kind of research.
Yeah, I understand that the city councilman recently voted tentatively that there seemed to be a sway of being in opposition to the mayor plan. But one thing I found real interesting in that particular makeup of the city council body in Richmond is that three of the councilmen are African descent, are African, and they support the plan, but there seems to be a large percentage of the African people in opposition to the plan. What do you make of that?
Well, let me make of it a political interest to museum and district into compromise. I think that what's going on is what you might call, or what you might term, a historic compromise to build a museum for slavery history, for slave history, versus another alternative route to commemorating the history. I am one of those people who would rather not be a mega museum if it means that a baseball stadium is the compromise. I'm one of the people who, perhaps like Doug Wilder, would like to see an interpretive exhibit at First Baptist Church, for example, which is at the end of the Trail of Enslaved Africans. I would rather see a small interpretive exhibit and experience and have the grounds remain developed as park space for the community. And when I say park space, there's a lot of opportunity that could be enfolded into that. But I would rather see a smaller interpretive kinds of spaces. An example may be to use the Emily Winifred Cottage for interpretive space, which is already there and is falling down from disrepair. Or, like I said, First Baptist Church, which is a suggestion that's used. I would rather those spaces used for interpretation rather than have a mega museum built in the place where there were so many auction houses.
So, Sister Monica, when we look at this issue that's going on between developing in the Chaco Slip Bottom area in Richmond, Virginia, and protecting the sacred grounds of the African ancestors, who are some of the economic players behind this whole issue in terms of wanting to build in that area? Who are some of the key players or agencies or community bodies that you would say are some of the key players that has an economic interest to build that area at the expense of the city?
Well, I would say that is a key economic player that's been identified. All of those typically listed as supporters of the plan. When you look at the paid advertisements that were circulated in the city, they listed themselves as supporters. And so those were the very same people that I said would be the economic player.
And I assume some of the folks that were listed in that advertisement were Jack Berry, the executive director of Venture Ritual, as well as Kim Schlesler, president and CEO of Greater Richmond Chamber of Commerce. They seem to be, from what I have researched in terms of some of the newspapers in this area, seem to suggest that they may be some of the power players behind this whole development. Based upon your research and knowledge, what you know about these organizations and these players?
Well, I know that they are what you may call movement detectives in the city of Richmond. They are they do philanthropy such as the Folk Festival in the city of Richmond. They support that kind of thing. They support the Richmond Jazz Festival. They support the Two Street Festival. They support a lot of cultural events around the city of Richmond. I'm interested in the history of what they have supported for African Americans specifically in the past. It's my interest at this time.
Now, has the city of Richmond, Dwight Jones, the mayor, in terms of just overall looking at his historical interest in the city, particularly in terms of the interest of the African community, does he have a history of being involved in those kind of interests and those kind of ideas historically, or is this something new in terms of based upon he has now become mayor of the city of Richmond to give the appearance of his interest in the African community is legitimate, according to your perspective?
I'm not familiar with what Mayor Jones has done in the past. I might be more familiar with what the business community has done, but I'm not familiar with the mayor.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we'd like to let our audience know that you are listening to Africa on the Move. We're talking to Sister Monica, who is one of the major organizers in opposition to any kind of development, and at the expense of the African burial grounds in this area that we call Chaco Slip in Richmond, Virginia. We have other residents in Richmond who have dialed in and would like to get our views and comments. Right now, we're going to take our first phone call. We can go to Brother Hakee. He's also another organizer in Richmond, and we'd like to hear his take on this whole issue. Brother Hakee, based upon your research, your analysis in terms of this issue, how do you frame it?
To say the least, it's somewhat of a convoluted situation that we're confronted with in terms of those questions around the burial ground. Clearly, historically, the history of African people has been denied, played down, dismissed. So we have a need in terms of telling our story. But there's a question in terms of, the more pragmatic needs of our citizenry, particularly with respect to employment. Now, the mayor raises the question in terms of employment. Viable employment. I don't know what he means by viable, but he's used the term viable. I'm assuming he's talking about jobs or decent wages, but somehow I certainly doubt that given the overall economic trend in society. I certainly doubt that wages are going to be viable. But in a bit, he's talking about employing, anywhere up to 400, 800 people, in the city, particularly, black youth, African youth, in terms of the development that's going to take place. Now, how do you balance that with the need, the historical needs of a people? One of the things this is alluded to is that the historical needs of a people is perhaps unprecedented, particularly when you talk about history related to African people, our people. This could do much in terms of enlightening our people, educating our people in terms of the gallant, the very noble history, the sacrifices, African people had to endure in terms of just survival in society. And so, therefore, it's a story that's incalculable in terms of, the needs of our children. So how do you balance the two? Now, Dwight Jones makes a position, the mayor makes a position, takes a position, that given the fact that historically Richmond has been centrally boxed in by the bigger counties, in particular Henrico and Chesterfield, and there's no question about that, the ability to expand the boundaries of Richmond is clearly the compromise. So on that point, he's absolutely correct. And there's no question that when we talk about the overall general malaise, economically speaking, of cities is well documented. In fact, when you look at major cities throughout the country, at a minimum, Richmond Point's estimated that the deficit in terms of government expenditures is in the area of $55 billion. So we talk about the cities being high-pressed in terms of need of cash and revenues. And so, therefore, a lot of cities have opted to, one, gentrify, or B, to develop, relatively small areas within the context of city boundaries. But having said that, I don't think that there is any I don't think that you can conflate the economic needs, that exist in a city with the needs of a people, particularly psychologically, when we talk about the overall devastations that has visited or impacted on the minds of so many of our people in terms of so many disparities, whether it be economic, political, social. And so clearly symbolism is very, very important. Clearly the articulation of our history by actually having the physical remnants of that history are so, so important to our people. So from a psychological point of view, the needs are incalculable. And so this is the dilemma that we're up against. Clearly, Dwight Jones' people take the position that we can do both. My position is that in terms of my understanding of this particular situation is that I'm not sure if, in fact, that the latter part, as relates to ensuring, the development of our historical sites, I'm not sure to the extent that that's going to. I think it's probably going to be compromised. I think that initially they're going to say that we're going to respect the boundaries and we're going to do all we can within the context of archaeological discovery, and we're not going to disturb the site. But I don't think that's genuine, because once they start building, there's nothing, there's no law, there's no precedent, there's no policy that says that you have to confine, construction to a particular site, even when it's articulated that the burial ground exists in the vicinity of these buildings that they're talking about building. So I think that I think the movement in Richmond with respect to the African burial grounds is a legitimate one. I think they have a very good point. The buses have a very good point in terms of maintaining the sanctity of that site and not even taking a chance that city officials and or key economic power players in Richmond would violate the oath in terms of preserving the historical site. So I think my position is that I don't trust it. I've seen this too many times before. Even though in South Carolina, in Charleston, South Carolina, they've been able to build a magnificent site in reference to black history in terms of burial sites and historical sites as related to African people, they did an excellent job. I'm not sure the same is going to be true of Richmond in terms of the authenticity of the people who allege to be concerned about the African burial ground. One of the things, when I read the paper, the local paper with the defenders, and we alluded to the fact that one of the guys, the Greater Richmond Chamber of Commerce, when he alluded to the question, we made a statement, who would want to visit an African burial ground? I mean, when you make those kind of statements, clearly they're not only inflammatory, but they're very insensitive, and they're very dismissive in terms of African burial ground. So then what real incentive would this individual have in terms of particularly those burial grounds? That is my concern. So it's something that I think that the people, particularly the African masses, you have to ruminate. They have to determine, you know, for themselves, you know, what is the best direction. My position is that the protection of the burger at all costs, you know, even to the extent that the economic imperative, as the mayor calls it, you know, to me becomes secondary.
That's an interesting position. I want you to stay there, Brother Hackey and Sister Monica. We're coming back. Let's give our, there's another young man on the phone. He's been waiting for a while. He's also lives in Richmond. Youth Brother Jabari, welcome to Africa on the Move. What is your take on the subject? Where do you stand? Yes, Brother Jabari, are you there? Okay, we'll come back to him. But what we'll do right now is I'd like to raise this with you, Sister Monica. In terms of the struggle that the people have engaged in around this issue of sacred burial ground and economic development, up to this point, if other cities confront this kind of issue, what lessons or things you maybe could share with them that would be of importance as it relates to maintaining or trying to maintain the sacredness of any African burial ground? What have you learned so far that people need to be aware of as you continue to engage into the struggle?
If I understand your question right, which is, let me repeat it to make sure I understand, what, based on other struggles for sacred ground around the country, what could we do here in Richmond better?
No, not what you can do in Richmond better. Based on what you have learned through this process, what can you share with other people that will help them in such a battle?
Being informed is, I think, a key aspect of preserving what you have. First, you must know what it is that you have. And I think information sharing and knowing who the key players are in whatever initiative is on the table is critical. And also, I think, in intergenerational perspective, one of the things that I really appreciated about the struggle in New York, for example, for their burial ground, that I don't see here, I don't think enough, is that they involved school children in what was going on, a current event, you know what I mean, as a current event in terms of information sharing. You know, I've only heard the dialogue from the adult perspectives. We have rarely heard it from children's perspectives. I don't see, you know, teachers talking about it enough, especially with, for example, Open High School being very participatory, you know, when we were talking about the school budget and economic development and they being very proactive, coming out and protesting at City Hall. You know, there were about 20 of them. But I think Richmond Public Schools has 20,000 children. So with that, you know, with the significance of this issue, have the information, you know, I guess I would wonder how much information has been shared with younger people about this issue.
Okay. That's a excellent point. In terms of this issue of the stadium, it was brought to my attention that, at least for Richmond, this particular stadium will not really generate any revenue for the city. If that is the case, why there's such a need to want to be a new stadium in the area versus maybe looking at going back to the Boulevard or revitalizing what we already have? What is your opinion on that particular argument, where some say we should just revitalize or use the one that we already have? And two, the issue, if the stadium will not generate money for the city, then why are we talking about building one? What's the hidden message or the hidden agenda behind building that particular stadium, from your perspective, Monica?
Well, I think that's the question. That's the million-dollar question that everybody wants to know. Why build it if it's not going to generate money? It's a surrounding development that is supposed to generate the income, per se. And so, you know, that is absolutely a key question. And in terms of economic development and generating income, and this sort of ties in with your earlier question as well, we, you know, around the country, I looked at other historic sites for generating income, generating tourism income, and, you know, what those dollars would look like. And I wish I had the figures here in front of me, but they were significant in terms of how much money tourist sites generate, period, and what is possible for Chaco Bottom if the history was honored. It was really astounding when you look at, you know, one of the largest revenue-producing monuments in the United States is the Statue of Liberty, and that is about the immigration of people from all over this world. And really, Chaco Bottom has that same kind of draw and pull in terms of people who had, who were forced to migrate, but still there was a migration of people who came through. Reported that more than 50% of the United States African Americans can trace their roots to Chaco Bottom. So the potential for revenue generation is very significant. So, again, that question about why a stadium is very, very important.
Brother Hattie, what is your take on this question? If we're going to be a stadium, but it's not going to reduce revenue, I mean, not going to do revenue, then what's the basis for building it? What's your understanding of the rationale behind it, if any?
Well, you know, one of the things, you know, if in fact it was to create revenue, then that's one question. But if you're going to build it, if you're going to build the stadium one place or another, and it doesn't generate revenue, of course, inevitably the question comes, who benefits? I don't think you have to be a rocket scientist to figure out that the beneficiaries are the very wealthy, the power brokers like here in the city, who can benefit from building a stadium, which has no real intrinsic value for the masses of people in terms of revenue only. So I think clearly the people who stand to benefit from this whole process are the people who are advocating the most for it, which are namely the powerful. And one of the things that I tell you, in terms of building a stadium in Chaco Bottom, one of the things is that, you know, we talk a lot about in terms of, when we talk about happens. One of the things is that if you create a stadium, that seems to me that will contribute to more congestion, not less congestion. So, therefore, if it's going to contribute to congestion, then the argument can be made that, in fact, it won't contribute to your economic earnings. It would actually decrease economic earnings, because what happens is that it will actually discourage people from coming down there. As it stands now, people are quite disenchanted with terms of the congestion that gets down there. For that reason, a lot of people go down Chaco Bottom for that reason. So if you're going to enhance the problem in terms of congestion, I don't see it being economically viable in terms of increase in revenue. I see it as decreasing economic revenues. So really, the logic behind creating a stadium in Chaco Bottom that's revenue, not even revenue neutral, that doesn't generate any revenue at all, seems to me the only real beneficiaries are the people, the most powerful people in the city.
Yeah, but in terms of your point, I think one of the things the mayor raised, and I'm directing that to both of y'all, Monica and Haki, and then we'll bring in the other callers who've been waiting so patiently. We'd like to thank you. But one of the positions I heard the mayor stated earlier was that in that area, if you put the stadium up there with the hotels, it will attract the people coming from off of 64 and 95 into the city instead of just bypassing the city. That's where the money will begin to come in, an attraction of people who drive through Richmond and what seems to have a basis to maybe make a stop. What is your response to that position?
Well, I think that we can try to, that it's a good idea to attract people off of the highway. The thing is that you have to attract with a meaningful attraction. You have to think about something that's going to touch the souls of people and make people want to come. And I don't think baseball is it. That's just, you know, that's my short answer. Baseball is not the thing that's going to touch the soul of the populace, the people. I just don't believe it is baseball. It has not been our favorite sport. It's not our favorite pastime, certainly not for African-Americans. And I don't know about for other people as well. It doesn't seem like it's that much of a past. You know, it's a pastime for sure, but I don't see the fervor behind baseball. The baseball stadium in where it is now is never full. Whenever I drive past it, and I've heard people say the same thing, it's never full. It doesn't draw that kind of attention or that kind of enthusiasm. And so
Monica, since you stated that, Brother Hackett, we'll come to you that you respond to that question, but you just made me realize that when you say the stadium that we have is never full, which right now can hold about 12,000 people, they are proposing that the new stadium will only hold 6,000 people. Maybe it'll be full then. What do you think, Monica?
Well, I think it could be full if where it's at, if they were upgraded perhaps. And the architect, the original architect, and he was an engineer, the original engineer of the stadium where it sits now, has come out to say that it was built with the express ability to be revised or renovated. And he laid out a plan for renovation, which would include enclosing the facility with glass, adding skyboxes, adding a restaurant, enhancing parking features. And so at minimal cost, there is the other option, which is to keep the baseball stadium where it is. And as a matter of fact, they probably reduce the size of it as well as the cost of the renovation. This is the engineer who originally built the facility. So,
and Brother Hackett, how do we, if it's baseball, trying to create revenue, how do you create revenue building a smaller stadium for the one you had previously, going for 12,000, 6,000? That seems to be a contradiction in terms of the rationale. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I think argument is counterintuitive, and I think this is absolutely correct. Clearly, the current stadium is not viable economically because people simply in the town don't have the interest in terms of sports generally. I can remember when the time when they had the football team, the Saints, the farm team for the Saints, or the Richmond Saints, and there's no support for whatsoever. The current football team later, there's no support for that. So clearly, it's not a sports town. So we can just mention that, in fact, that is revenue enhancing, and see if it is. That is simply a ploy in terms of building a space in which people own a property down in Chocolate Bottom tend to make a lot and lots of money. I think one thing is also that I'm saying is that when we talk about accessibility, you know, clearly on the boulevard, the city is much more accessible to those individual passengers 64-95 quarter as opposed to moving into Chaco Bottom. So what happens is that accessibility, because it becomes more complicated, it's not likely to get people to come here. Now, whether or not the shopping facilities that they're talking about creating will be driving force in terms of encouraging people to come, it's questionable. Unless those marketplaces going to offer something that's extraordinary, something that's different, something that's avant-garde, something that can be found elsewhere. I don't think it's being particularly conducive toward, you know, increasing revenues for the city. This is the problem that we're confronted with. Now, keep in mind also, when you talk about, you know, building this stadium, the question is the city doesn't have the expertise in terms of erecting that stadium, so which means that it has to be contracted out, which means expenditures of lots and lots of money. And that stadium has to be funded some kind of way. The mayor intimated that it may be private dollars were responsible for building it. But it's quite possible that private sources put it together in terms of, you know, in terms of building it. But I still doubt it. Generally what happens to contract the cities, when you talk about those kind of projects, they contract them out. And so which gives cities an opportunity, you know, to sell bonds to finance the project. which in terms of economic sense makes more sense in terms of, you know, enhancing the economy as opposed to, you know, private individuals, you know, actually using private dollars to build a stadium. So I think it makes no sense at all, Brother Africa. You know, I think it's just a ploy. I think those people who are wealthy want it here, and I think that given the fact that the mayor is so adamant that it be built, suggests there's a lot of pressure on him in terms of making sure the deal is done. So, you know, I don't think it's particularly viable in terms of economic sense, you know, for the community.
Okay, we'd like to let our listening audience know that you are listening to Africa on the Move with your host, Brother Africa. The first hour, we're speaking on a particular history issue as it relates to the history of the Richmond, Virginia, particularly as it relates to the African community. We're talking about how well protected any African burial ground, in this case, is one, the one in the Chaco Bottom area for the Africans in Richmond, how well should be protected. At the expense of economic development in terms of the overall general interest of the city, how do you balance the two, or can the two be balanced? We are having discussion with Monica and Brother Haki and other individuals who would like to call in at 323-679-0841. We begin to see this issue is beginning to receive national attention outside of Richmond. And what is its implication in general when we talk about an oppressed people having the right to defend the integrity of their history and the works of their ancestors? How do the two collide when you talk about historical interests of maintaining your dignity versus the interests of making money for a small sector of your community? So right now what we're going to do, we have some individuals been waiting. We're going to try again, go to caller 3330. Your question or comment, please.
I'd like to make a comment.
Okay.
And doing some research, I recently came across an economic study that related to the city of Richmond, Virginia, and it was showing that unless something has changed, it's on the same economic trajectory as the city of Detroit, Michigan. We know that Detroit is facing heavy economic issues from water sanctions and other issues that have people in Detroit really trying to just fight for their survival. And now, given that Richmond is on that same trajectory, it's very interesting that rather than focusing on meeting the needs of the people that live there, you will want to take this gamble and focus on something that's supposed to guarantee economic expansion, only there's nothing guaranteeing that it will succeed and it could leave the city even more in debt than what it already is.
That's an interesting observation. So anyone would like to respond to the observation?
I think it's probably the same argument that the mayor would make. I think he would say that given the overall economic trends, that we're running the gamut of possibly ending up like Detroit, where everything is privatized, where people, you know, from the state will come and actually run the city in terms of selling off the city's assets to private individuals under the guise that they're much more efficient if they did it that way. So I think for the mayor's position, that's a very real concern. But I think that if we're concerned about in terms of raising revenue, I think probably the better way to do it in terms of the human raising revenue is simply to develop that burial ground, make it elaborate, make it very, very nice, something comparable to what they did in South Carolina, make it very, very nice, promote it. And I'm sure that people will come in because there is this fascination in terms of African history. I was recently in Jackson, Mississippi, and I ran into some young ladies out of France, who come to New Orleans and Jackson, Mississippi every year because they love the history in terms of the colonial history as it relates to African people. And so there is this fascination, there is a desire to want to know more about the history, but it simply has to be marketed. So I think the potential in terms of, you know, being economically viable lies in, you know, some grand development that you're dedicated to African burial ground and African history, the history of African people. I think that would probably be a better way to go. Of course, in doing that, one of the things it does, it effectively cuts out the middleman or those wealthy individuals who want to profit, from having land down in Chaco Bottom, who see the golden opportunity to make lots and lots of money at the city's expense. So I think we have to decide, just in terms of the political arena, if we're really sincere about economics, then we have to look at in terms of developing that burial ground, making something grand, promoting that, and increasing the opportunity or the possibility that we're going to actually, see revenue enhancement. So I think, from my perspective, I think that's the best way to go if you're sincere about it. But I don't think people in power are particularly concerned about economics. I think they're concerned about economics to the extent that it impacts their pockets, and not necessarily the overall the general good of the economy.
And
okay,
I would concur with that. Yeah, I just would like to concur with that point and encourage everybody to think about how the economy is moving generally. And to his point, privatization is the new trend. Everything is going into private hands, even public projects such as transportation. Large trend in privatizing roads. And so that has not been good for the public in years past, and I don't think it's good for the public now. And so if we could, as he pointed to, make these grounds, which have been fought over for the public good, preserved for the public good, I think would be a tremendous success. Because privatization, as you said, only is good for a very small population of the people, and it shuts out opportunities for everybody else.
Okay, what I would like you to do, we'll take this caller, and when we come back after this caller, Monica Hackey and Jabari, since we understand y'all live in Richmond, I would like to ask y'all about this recent change of policy in terms of how you have restructured your buses and what this is all about. So right now we have caller 6057. Caller 6057, welcome to Africa on Your Move. Your question, comments based upon the discussion tonight so far.
Okay, Brother Africa, thanks for having me on the program today. I apologize for running a little late. It was a schedule conflict that I had to resolve. From what I've heard from the discussion so far, I agree with your two panelists this evening that that as to developing the African burial ground into a memorial would be more beneficial to the people living in Richmond long term than building a new stadium. And the thing about a stadium is that it is of relatively limited use. It's not guaranteed to generate much in the way of tourism necessarily. It depends on such things as the popularity and the success of the sports team that's using the stadium and that sort of things. And those things can fluctuate up and down very wildly. And if it's, as Haki indicated, Richmond is in a kind of financial trouble that it's in right now, it seemed like it would be more interested in continuing to utilize an existing stadium since it is not filled to capacity anyway, and actually developing the burial ground as something that could attract tourists all year round, not just doing the particular sport that's in season. And usually when it comes to these kind of decisions, politics and economics come into play. So.
Okay, Brother Anthony, that's Brother Anthony. I'm out of New Jersey. Speaking of that, I see in New Jersey, Brother Anthony, they have a problem with the casinos, talking about shutting down and moving out, and we can look at some of the sports stadiums that y'all have had issues with. So This is not really a new phenomenon in terms of this question of corporate power versus what's in the best interest of the people, regardless of what this is at stake. But what I would like to do right now is to go back to Brother Jabari. Brother Jabari, I'd like to start with you, dear. We'll come with Brother Hackey and Brother Monica. In terms of the recent decision of reroute and reschedule the Richmond public buses off of Broad Street and move them to other off areas away from Broad Street, to me, it sort of reminds me a little bit of Sun City in Azania, South Africa. What does y'all make of that policy and that decision? And what kind of impact the people are feeling as a result of that?
Mm-hmm. Well, being a former student at Virginia Commonwealth University, you know, it's a grave injustice in regards to this rerouting, because the thing that was most people who were advocates of using public transportation is that the routes were convenient. They were in areas that were accessible to people. And now you're talking about, especially in hazardous weather condition, people have to walk further to utilize that, which was their main means of transportation. So you're looking at something that is greatly negatively impacting the people and doing the opposite of what it's doing, because they say it's public transportation, but it's going to make people reexamine, look at other means of getting to transportation because of it not necessarily being in a central location anymore.
Haki, what's your take of this new phenomenon? Moving the buses off Broad Street and...
Yeah, the young brother has a point. But, you know, one of the things, and I'm going to be very candid, because I'm not one who believe in a lot of, abstract talk when it comes to problems. One of the things we have to understand is that, you know, African people are perceived in biological negative light. We perceive as problematic in terms of economic earnings. One of the things is that recently, Apple is in the process of creating, not Apple, but I can't even call it an organization, but in the process of creating an app which people can utilize in terms of pretty much assessing the state of affairs from location to location. In other words, they'll be able to tell whether the community is a good one or a negative one, a bad one, a criminal one, blah, 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 okay? And, of course, you know, it's doublespeak. You know, it's a dog whistle. Of course, we know what they're talking about when they talk about bad areas. See, we know it's an issue for African people by and large or poor people. We understand precisely what they're saying. So the issue in terms of our visibility has always been a concern among the public because our presence connotes all those things that are negative. This is problematic. And so for the power elite, the essentially what they want to do is to hide us. And so when people are means walking down Broad Street, they don't see any African people at all. And of course, it creates a perception in the minds of those who are powerful that, in fact, that Richmond, quote unquote, is a safe place. In this sense, African is being equated with criminality. So therefore, if you don't see any African people by extrapolation, it means that it's safe. So let's be clear about what the implication is in terms of what they're doing, why they're doing what they're doing. That's precisely why they're doing what they're doing. In terms of the comfort factor, they're not concerned about the comfort factor. You know what I mean? They're not even necessarily concerned about the economic factor, because it makes no sense to have people, you know, in these areas which are way off the beaten path in terms of catching a bus, whereas historically right there in Richmond, centrally located, you maximize your earnings by having people have easier accessibility to buses. So I don't think economics is the issue per se. I think that the issue in terms of its creating perception that Richmond, quote-unquote, a safe place, quote-unquote, a less African place. So I think this is in part and parcel the philosophy behind what they're doing in terms of the buses. So that's my view on that.
Sister Monica, what's your take?
My take is it's a very visible situation. They have, you know, the citizenry has spoken up about their concerns. You know, one of the things that I noticed and was most concerned about was that some buses are routed, but apparently not all buses are routed off of Broad Street. So, You know, the buses that are coming in from the counties, they're apparently still dropping off on Broad Street, but it's not the same thing for those inner city routes. Rather than talk about what a travesty it is, would like to hear more of the perspective from the bus riders. And, you know, I've heard one or two come down to city council. I certainly would like to see more people who are involved in how to fix that.
Okay. To our listening audience, you are listening to Africa on the Move as your host, Brother Africa. Our first half of the program was basically dedicated to taking a look and a perspective at what is going on in the city of Richmond, Virginia, as it relates to the issue of sacred African burial ground versus economic development. You have heard some views and perspectives from Sister Monica, Brother Aki, Brother Zabari, as well as Brother Anthony. And before we close out, we do have one more caller right there on the line. I would like to get him in. He's been waiting real patiently. I'd like to bring in Brother Moses and let him just give his perception on what has been stated tonight and his take. At the end, we're going to take a station break. And Sister Monica, we'll give you a few minutes to say some final words to our audience and also let our audience know how can they get involved with some of the organizations that you're working with. But right now, Brother Moses, welcome to Africa on the Move. What is your take so far on the subject matter?
Well, thank you. The struggle there in Richmond for dignity and respect for our people is obviously intensified and it continues. I'm glad that there's people on the front line who understand the situation and who are working on it, and I'm honored to be able to communicate my views with them this evening. I know all people have a history, and some history is worth preserving and some not worth preserving, but we can't deny anybody's history. The most horrendous history would be the Holocaust of the slave trade, and we can't forget it, and we can't because we have institutionalized racism, basically, with U.S. being the first apartheid state to codify apartheid, and that institution has not been thoroughly overthrown because it's built up in tradition and codified laws to where you can be in jail for smoking while colored and whatever. And so I don't know, the struggle continues, and I just hope people are not discouraged and will continue on.
Okay, thank you, Brother Moses. Hold on. Right now, we'll give our Sister Monica a few minutes of her final thoughts and share with the audience in terms of how can they maybe contact her and work with some of the organizations that she's involved. Sister Monica, it's all yours right now.
Oh, well, good, thanks. I appreciate the floor. I want to thank all the callers, and particularly Brother Moses who just called in. We appreciate your appreciation of the work that we do. Any kind of support and assistance, we're always very thankful for. The mission of the African Ancestral Chamber is to preserve and maintain the sacredness and legacy of African ancestors. And one of the things that I can't stress enough is that this fight that we're in the middle of is not just about slave history. As horrible as it was, being, like you said, a Holocaust of our people, we are also fighting for our resistance to that. We are also fighting for the story of Harriet Tubman, who ran the Underground Railroad right on through Richmond. You never hear a story about her there, but, she had to have come through. We're not talking about the story of Shaco Bottom also being the home of African-American capitalism. We're not talking about the story of African troops. We were called U.S. color troops, but we were not American citizens, so therefore we were really African troops who came through in the only all-black, or I should say all-African regiment and ended slavery in Richmond. So these are just some of the stories. Going back to this whole thing about the transportation, all of this stuff is interwoven in our journey. But the thing that keeps us strong, you know, when we look about this, think about this transportation issue, we must remember that our strongest leader has something to do with transportation. And I'm hoping that something really exceptionally good is going to come out of this whole transportation situation. Think about Marcus Garvey and the Black Star Line. Think about Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks and them on the bus. You know, all of our great, great leaders, their platform was transportation. So maybe we ought to really look at that transportation theme in a very serious light. Ways to get in touch with us, my phone number is area code 804.
How can people make contributions to you? Share with folks. Go ahead.
Good, thanks. Phone number is 804-363-3282. You can reach me if you'd like to make contributions. You can do so by PayPal at afrocitytours@gmail.com. Please put in the subject matter that this is contribution for Shackle Bottom or preservation of sacred ground. And also you can reach us by email, which is africanchamber2011@gmail.com. So that's two emails if you'd like to make a contribution to afrocitytours@gmail.com, because we have there's a PayPal account at that email address, and then also africanchamber2011@gmail.com. Thank you, Brother Lee, for that.
Monica, we'd like to thank you. We'd like to tell the rest of our participants to hold on. We're going to take a pause for a call. So when we come back, we're going to talk about some international issues that really have an impact on us, our communities and world, and issues that people are scared to speak to. But, you know, Africa on the Move, we speak truth to power. When we come back, we're going to the so-called Middle East, to the West Bank, Gaza Strip. We'd like to hear your views and comments and others. So you have been listening to Africa on the News, Africa on the Move, as your host, Brother Africa. We're going to be back in 2 minutes. We will take this pause for we will take this pause for a cause.
Africa, at the center of the world. Latitude 0, longitude 0, planned by the Creator. Sesanthropus was the first man found on the earth. That earth was the motherland, Africa. We know that without total understanding of what happened in the past, it would be difficult to relate to the future. We know that within the structure of the music, there should be a message, and the message should be truth. So now, we give you Africa, the center of the world.
Thank you.
Yes, that's right. Sorry for the delay. Africa is the center of the world. It's the nucleus. We recognize that there's a saying, the more things change, the more they remain the same. And we know that was a scramble in the fight for Africa during the Berlin Conference, 1884-85, to see who would control Africa, its resources and people. And now this scenario is replaying itself over again. Who will control Africa in the year 2014? We see the development of AfroCon. We see the development of the EU as a political bloc and trying to use their influence to dominate the essence of the well-being of Africa, African people. And in essence, imperialism has now intensified its foothold on our home, Africa. Question becomes, like in 1884-85, what was the response? And one of the response to that question or that issue or that dilemma was a call for Africans to unite, the concept of pan-Africanism. But as I said, it was the basis for it, but it was maybe a formation understanding necessity of what we were already in the process of trying to do. That was, we were on an evolutionary process of uniting Africa into one strong and powerful home. Speaking of that, we're going to talk about it first in the so-called Middle East, which most people don't recognize, not really talking about Africa, what's going on in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, as relates to the victimizer and those who are claiming to be the victims. We say that when we talk about the Palestinian people, in the West, they put a spin that they are the ones responsible for their own problems. This atrocity that's going on in bombing a group of people, and the whole world seems to be saying nothing. The masses are speaking, but those in power and those who are responsible, those who have the media to communicate with the world, they have a total opposite position. So we'd like to just have some discourse on right now the plight of the Palestinian people, what's going on in the Middle East, even in Iraq. Recently, the U.S. government dropped two bombs, and they're bombing Iraqi now, again trying to figure out how they would maintain control and domination of that region. So in terms of people giving their analysis, we start with Brother Haki. Right now, Brother Haki, this whole so-called Middle East area from Palestine to Iraq, what is your take? What is going on? And how you feel about this bombing of a grouping of people who are really defenseless in terms of looking at the technologies that they are confronted with?
Well, I think what's going on in the Middle East generally, I think the question in terms of who's going to control that region. That's no question. There's a tremendous amount of resources in terms of oil. And, of course, oil is the... the product that runs the world. And so the question is, who's going to control the supply of oil? And clearly, Israel plays a big part in terms of that whole process. Now, keep in mind, Israel is just the it's complicit in this whole process, that it's not the primary actor. But historically, when Israel acts, when it does things that are very, very inhuman, are very, very destructive, generally is at the bidding of America. And so clearly when you look at the kind of the expenditures, the amount of money America is spending, given to Israel, the kind of military might, hardware, victory that America is providing Israel, then clearly that America sees Israel's actions in its best interest. In fact, one of the things that was recently reported was that the president of Israel, Netanyahu, actually had the audacity to tell Obama, you know, don't question him. In other words, don't get in his way. And so, therefore, you know, if you want Israel to carry out your will, then let us do it. But, you know, but don't critique us in terms of how we do it. We do it based upon what we see as an Israel best interest. One of the things, you know, also when you talk about the boundaries of Israel, one of the things that those boundaries back in 67, which was a plan approved by the UN in which they agreed to stick to the boundaries of 67. Israel has never been honest in terms of its word in terms of keep not not violating those boundaries. There have been often been excursions into, of Israel, into the Gaza Strip for whatever reason. And always when they do that, they're justified by, well, the Hamas, for example, is being aggressive, so therefore we had no other course but to destroy the entire infrastructure of the Palestinian nation. So the viciousness of Israel is nothing new. In fact, it's been going on for a long, long time. I think what is extraordinary is the extraordinary silence of the so-called Muslim nations who acquiesce to what's going on by virtue of their silence. So to your question, yes, not surprising that it's going on in the Middle East because it's all about the control of the oil supply. Even though Halliburton has tremendous investments in Iraq oil, there's a concern about peak oil. In other words, there's concern that this oil is going to dry up, and so therefore you won't have opportunities to have access to much more oil. And so the greater the region you have control over, the more access you have to oil. And so therefore it's in the U.S. interest to ensure that or to back Israel in terms of its destructiveness.
Brother Abdi, what's your take on what's going on in that region?
I concur with Haki's observations, and I would add that what's going on in Gaza and Iraq is somewhat related in the fact that you have two imperialist forces that are trying to maintain control over the oil supply in that region. Gaza, from what I read, has relatively large reserves of oil. And that's what's partly at root of the current conflict, the current genocide that's going on is the effort of the Zionist state to get control of the oil, in that region.
Okay, Brother Jabari, would you like to have to add anything to this? What is your analysis of the situation?
I'd like to say that it is clear and deliberate sabotage in what's going on in that particular region because you alluded to the fact earlier that some of the areas attacked are areas where there are large amounts of civilians, and anybody that has any basic understanding of warfare know that the way to keep the war effort going is to attack those areas where civilians are and people aren't able to defend themselves in the hopes that your enemy will surrender out of fear of what will happen to that population.
Israel's observation, Brother Moses, where are you on this issue?
Well, I've done a few things on this issue, and just to sum it up, quite frankly, Israel's mission since its beginning has been to kill, steal, and destroy anything that's not Jewish on that land, and they worship that land, and they will kill, steal, and destroy anything that's trying to eliminate that government. The people are one thing, the government's another. And, the people were getting along before they came there with these foreigners and established this government. The situation will never be resolved until that government is resolved.
Okay,
but Brother Esther raises a very good point. We have to begin to make a distinction between Jews and Zionists. And so there are two different entities, and we have to be very, very clear on that. A lot of times they're conflated, as one. People see Zionists as Jews and Jews as Zionists. In fact, they're two different things. So what we're talking about is a Zionist element. These people are hardcore political. Now, they had a big protest in London yesterday, and which people equated Zionism with Nazism. When you look at the behavior in terms of Zionism, in terms of destructiveness, the malice, the hatred, clearly the mindset, philosophically speaking, is tantamount to Nazism in terms of ruthlessness in which they carry out their missions. So so historically, when you look at in terms of Zionism, you look at the evolution of this religion called Judaism, that clearly the leading people who led that movement were not Jewish, they were Zionists. They didn't believe in religion. They believed in economic political power, and that was their whole motivation. And so there's a distinction between the two. There are those who actually believe in the spiritual dimensions in terms of Judaism, and those who think religion doesn't exist, that all that matters is power. And so what we're talking about, Zionists, you know, Netanyahu and that bunch, the Knesset and the rest of them, these individuals are Zionists. They're not Jewish. They're very hardcore political.
Okay, I just want to add to what Haki is saying, that that we have to make this, be careful to make this distinction between Zionism and Judaism. Judaism is a religious, is a religion that emerged out of Africa. Zionism is a political movement that emerged out of Europe in the late 1800s. Around 1897 is when it took its modern organizational form. And to add to that, the founder of the Zionist movement, Theodor Herzl, was an atheist. He had contempt for Judaism, as a matter of fact. And a lot of people, because of the sources we receive information from, are very confused on this question. It's really important to add that.
Yeah, and also, Weizmann also, the co-founder of Zionism, also was anti-Jewish. He had no respect for spirituality, Judaism. He had no respect for it. So we understand exactly what we're dealing with, so we have to make that distinction so your audience understand exactly what we're talking about.
Mm-hmm. And to add to the point, it's a saying that we must remember that every Jew is not a Zionist, and every Zionist is not a Jew.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Africans can be Zionists. Those who support the regime of the State of Israel, that's what most people identify as being Zionists, pro-Zionists. Maya Angelou was one of the greatest supporters of Zionism, even though many people, when they write their history, they write her as being a great principal young lady. But that was one of the major errors that she has made in terms of her position on this question of Zionism. She's a Zionist, just as an example. Then you got other Jews who are not Zionists. But go ahead, Brother Rob.
Yeah, during the 1890s and the 1900s, in the Soviet, well, it was Russia then. It was, you know, the Tsar's Russia. And Lenin and Stalin and Trotsky and all of them were running around trying to make a revolution. One of the key issues was this concept of Zionism. And there was what they call the Jewish Bund was the party. And it's the party that's in Israel right now, too. But anyway, the Jewish Bund, they wanted cultural national autonomy. You know, they wanted a right to sovereignty and statehood based upon cultural national autonomy, basically based upon religion, ultimately. And Stalin wrote a book, read several articles and books on the national question, Marxism and the national question, where he clarified what a nation was, defined what a nation was, laid it all out plain and clear, and showed them that it was pure idealism and it wasn't that scientific socialism, they could not support it, and that endeared Stalin to Lenin. Lenin, that was what one of the things that endeared Stalin to Lenin was his great work on the national question, because Stalin was a minority. He was a Georgian. He wasn't a great Russian. But I blame Trotskyism for being sort of the fifth column, you know, and this petty bourgeois revolutionism and this constant criticism of the proletarian line of revolution. And anyway, but eventually the Bund, you know, of course, when Hitler came along, they gave them the material conditions which would make the idea more attractive. The sign is a more attractive because the Jews have been persecuted and burned in ovens and stuff. And I've been to Dachau in Germany, so I know it's real. There's no question in my mind. And the Jews have been persecuted, but they just chose to follow these political leaders and go to a land that did not belong to them. This is the result.
But one of the things, Brother Robert, Brother Moses, is that, and Lilienthal's book, The Zionist Connection, even there's a Jewish activist named, a young fellow named David Coles, dispute a lot of the things that we perceive as reminiscent of Jewish history. For example, one of the things that we talk about, the great Holocaust, we talk about all these bad things that happened to Jewish people. Of course, number one, we understand a lot of people who were ethnic minorities suffered. So that's the first thing. More importantly, what we don't talk about, the part the Zionists play in fomenting a lot of destruction that took place, over there, in Germany. Nor do we talk about the Exodus prior to this kind of destruction, inflicted upon Jewish people, Jewish quote unquote Jewish people. And this notion that 6 million people died is not true. This is the point that David Coles make in terms of his scholarship, in terms of his travel to places like Germany and Poland, in terms of getting at the truth. So this number of 6 million was something that the designers took out the Bible and made it and started saying it over and over again to give it legitimacy. So even today, people talk about 6 million Jews died. No, it wasn't 6 million Jews that died. And they talk about, at the most, they're talking about 600,000 people, which is a lot of people. Okay. So this is the thing in terms of the kind of power, the kind of how skilled they are in terms of disinformation and propaganda, in terms of, propagating these lies and getting people to repeat the lies. So this is the thing that we have to begin to debunk. So I think everybody should read Lilienthal's book, The Zionist Connection, and read the articles by David Cole. So they're very good. They're very enlightening in terms of what really happened in terms of Nazi Germany, in terms of historical atrocity.
Okay, can we get people speak to this issue of looking at the bombing of the Palestinian people? How do we get, or how do you create a society where they can openly show people being mass murdered? And you claim to be a religious institution such as the Christian Church. You don't have one minister, particularly a minister of African heritage, says anything about this brutal act. How do you create a culture that allows people to just dismiss what's taking place now? And as well as, Africa alone in the Congo has lost 6 million people, and most of the world, particularly those in the U.S., knows nothing about it. How do you create this kind of culture of ignorance?
Combination of things about Africa. Control of the educational system and control of the mass media. And in the case of the U.S., what's affecting the Africans who live in this part of the diaspora is that the Zionists pretty much control both. And Malcolm spoke about the ability of the imperialists to manipulate the way people think. I mean, information can be presented in such a way that it can make a people love their enemies and hate their friends. And a system that's capable of doing that is a very vicious system. And that's what we're confronted with. I mean, in the media, Palestinians are consistently being portrayed as terrorists or something other than human beings. And similarly, in the entertainment industry, Africans are portrayed a lot of times as not being human. So if you keep getting bombarded with this information with nothing to counter it, then you're gonna start believing the information that's being fed to you, because you have nothing going on to challenge, that information. So I think that's why we've become desensitized to what is happening to the Palestinians, not realizing that is wrong, and that free tests to be set up where something like this could happen to Africans in Africa and in the diaspora as well, if we don't organize to oppose this.
Brother Africa is right. Out of sight, out of mind. He controls the media, controls the way people think. When you talk about 6 million Africans in the Congo who were killed, you know, how many people know about that? Does the media talk about it? No. Unless people make a concerted effort to find or educate themselves, they will never know. After all, the value of African life isn't important. So we don't even the thought of 6 million Africans dying is almost inconsequential in the minds of a lot of people. And I'm not just talking about white people. I'm talking about all the African people who think that their passing or their destruction is irrelevant. It's inconsequential. It's no concept of no concern. So this is what we're dealing with in terms of the role, in terms of propaganda and disinformation, in terms of not only desensitizing people to destruction of brown people, African or brown people, but people actually being comfortable, you know, with that kind of destruction. Now, conversely, when you look at the Jewish people, people have been miseducated to believe the fact that these people are, in fact, the remnants of the people in the Bible that we talk about. We talk about Jews and Israelites in the Bible. These people have nothing at all to do with the Jews in the Bible. These Ashkenazis out of Poland and out of Germany, they have absolutely nothing to do with those Jews who are in the Bible that you read about. But people have been miseducated, believe in fact that they represent something holy, something spiritual. And so therefore, you know, their destruction, quote unquote, or anything that threatens to harm them is in fact of concern. And it's absurd. And this Christian notion that in fact in order for Jesus to come back, you know, these Jews must be destroyed in order for the Messiah to return to earth. It's sort of ironic. I mean, if in fact that this notion that it has to be wholesale destruction in order for the Messiah to come back doesn't seem to me to make any sense at all. Since when you look at destruction on a global scale, there's a lot of killing, a lot of destruction going on. So certainly that should be, if you would think, that there are grounds for the Messiah to return, given the destruction that already exists around the world. But these people actually think destruction hasn't happened to the Jews, and so therefore they have an invested interest in protecting the Jews and making sure, you know, the Jews can do whatever they want to do, that they're protected, they're provided for, blah, 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 because if they're not around, then the Messiah won't return. So therefore they want them there, so you can have this great upheaval or mass destruction, and then the Messiah can return. So it's a lot of insanity that exists. A lot of miseducation exists in terms of just what is a Jew, just what is the religion of Judaism in the minds of people. And so therefore, until we, like Brother Anthony said, until we change that paradox and begin to read and understand, you know, the precise history in terms of the evolution of human beings, which comes out of Africa, you know, we never put into context, you know, the kind of things that are going on, particularly those things that are destructive, you know, to people of color around the world.
Brother Moses, in response to what has been said recently?
Yeah, I mean, everybody's on point. I can only supplement and compliment what's being said. Obviously the Bible has been very critical in terms of written history, and you have to give honor where honor is due. They have contributed a lot in terms of civilization and humanity has definitely been affected by the Bible and the interpretation of the Bible. Basically, I mean, the kingdom of heaven is preaching, so everybody's interpretation of the Bible. It's really been the critical thing. Marxism, you know, came because the Bible is ultimately bourgeois ideology. I mean, it's laissez-faire capitalism, and you in order for the proletariat to gain power and to really carry out its mission, we need a science, and that's what Marxism-Leninism is all about. A science, a proletarian science, a working class science that looks out for the interests of the working class, and so you know the Bible is not, I mean it's not hostile ultimately, but there is a divide, and there's a separation of church and state, there's a separation of religion and politics.
Yeah, I'd just like to add this one point. We don't want to talk about the Bible in Western history. You're really not talking about the original document in which where that Bible really came from. What I'm saying is that Bible is a version for King James. That's something they concocted for original textbooks that eventually came out of Africa. They rearranged these stories. They rearranged the realities and put in the European mass conception. And I think that's one of the biggest problem contradictions we have had. Because one thing we do know about Europe, that Europe contributed nothing in terms of the development and the creation of major religions. All your major religions came from outside of Europe, came into Europe. Europe made no contribution in the area. So, you know, we got to be very careful and look at the original source in which how history is told and presented. But anyway, we're looking at this question in terms of what's going on in the Middle East. Let's talk a little bit about this recent meeting of these so-called African presidents coming to Washington, D.C. to meet with the President of the United States, Barack Obama. And what may have came out of this meeting, and what's the symbolism of these presidents all coming to him, and they sitting there discussing the future of Africa. Brother Anthony, have you ran across any kind of information or gives analysis of what is this all about?
This meeting and the proposed 8th Pan-African Congress is a cover for entrenching AFRICOM in Africa. In other words, entrenching the imperialist forces long-term in Africa, led by the U.S. government, which is why I think the significance of why this meeting took place in the U.S. Let's see. One of the characteristics of imperialism is that the struggle for the redivision of the world intensifies, and Africa, it right now is the highest piece of real estate, whether Africans in the diaspora and Africans on the continent understand that or not, because the bulk of the resources that imperialism needs to sustain itself, particularly its military, are to be found in Africa. So I think what is happening is that imperialism is looking for a way to continue its domination and expand it if at all possible. And with the neocolonialist politicians that are ahead of a lot of these states in Africa, this meeting and the 8th pact are being used as a cover, just as the 7th pact was used as a cover to intensify the Rwandan conflict in Eastern Africa.
Okay, Brother
Harry. Yeah, they talk about we're going to give Africa $500 million, not for infrastructure development, but security. Well, let me translate what that means in terms of security. What they're talking about is those military formations, AFRICOM in particular, that they currently got running throughout the continent, destabilizing governments, killing African leaders, killing progressive forces in Africa. So, as Brother Anthony alluded to, the struggle is on once again for Africa. Africa is a centerpiece in terms of world stability. To the extent that Africans throughout the diaspora understand that, in fact, you know, Africa is under attack for the resources, it's the only way conceivable that we're going to actually put an end in terms of the slaughter and the mayhem that's taking place on the continent. Now, people should understand, because Barack Obama's skin is brown doesn't mean that he concretely give a damn about the suffering or the injustice inflicted upon African people on the continent. His job is to promote a system which is predatory. When Bob Marley thinks about the system being like a vampire sucking the blood of sufferers, that's precisely what it does. And because we're so disorganized on the continent, because there is so much corruption among the African leaders, Africa, unfortunately, has historically paid a hell of a price in terms of, carnage, suffering, pain, poverty, you name it. So that process is repeating itself again. And, so although it's important that the African diaspora, particularly those Africans in America, wake up and understand concretely what it is going on, and to begin the dialogue in terms of what's going on. Because a lot of times, given the colonial educational system in Africa, a lot of Africans are ill-prepared to actually understand or even decipher precisely, what U.S. intervention or Western intervention generally means in terms of their lives. So this is a problem that we're confronted with. But Barack Obama is interesting. When you talk about 50 states in Africa, 50 countries, and he's talking about $500 million for security purposes, it is interesting. $500 million is dropping the bucket when you talk about investments in Europe. So even though these investments are for security reasons only, even in that sense, he's not talking about large sums of money. That he's convinced that with a paltry sum of money, that he can destabilize Africa, liquidate his leaders, foment dissent among those African leaders they don't like, with just $500 million. So this is the kind of lack of respect that they have for Africa and African leadership. So this is the problem that we're going to find it with. And, of course, seeing Zuma on the stage, this guy's an idiot. I mean, I don't know any other way to put it. He's an idiot. I had an opportunity to listen to him when I was in South Africa. I mean, this guy's just an idiot. I mean, he just doesn't have a clue. Aside from building big houses, big mansions for himself, and chasing women, now this guy has no clue in terms of the world polity. You know what I mean? So this is the situation we're confronted with in terms of the continent. So, and make no mistake about it, what happens to Africa adversely affects Africans in America. So don't think it's a disconnect that somehow I don't care, I don't live it. I'm an American, so I don't care about what happens in Africa. Oh, you will care. If you don't understand the relationship now, at some point, you will understand the relationship. Because just as they're contemporaries of Africans on the continent, they're contemporaries of Africans born in America. So we got to understand that connection. And we got to begin to address that, work together, unify, create a scientific, socialist continent, which is not only good for Africa, but good for the world.
Brother Moses. Hmm.
Yeah, that $500 million. I'm glad he put that in his proper perspective, because that's what I was thinking. I think what was it, $3.5 billion? That's a billion. Something they're trying to give to Israel now to replenish their weapons and the little things that they've blown up. And like the logic, the method to the madness is, in terms of the Palestinian, is they're shooting maybe hundreds, maybe 1,000 at the most, dollar rockets over into Israel, and Israel's using $100,000 per interceptor, $100,000 per interceptor. And so that's where the money, it's a business. Sooner or later, it's going to have an impact on the economy. They need to get money from the U.S. of A. They're not self-sustaining.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I would just like to add to this piece is that, you know, it's true, those who fail to learn their history, they ain't doomed to repeat again. This meeting with Barack Obama is another form or manifestation of Rick Ian becoming a Buffalo Soldier. We're going off to fight wars for someone else's interests. They have set up this special rapid deployment military force. From my understanding, right now, the leading countries who will serve that role will be Ghana. Ghana, Kenya, Kenya, Ethiopia, Senegal, and five of them. There was one more.
And Guinea.
No, I don't think Guinea was the one for this one. For the rapid development force they're talking about setting up.
Nigeria.
To act on the behalf of the UN, the AU, and actually the US in terms of being coordinated by AFRICOM. These soldiers will go to other countries and put down so-called threats, terrorist threats and stuff throughout the continental aspect of Africa. We are now being used again to fight against ourselves and for the interest of someone else. This is neocolonialism and imperialism in its highest form. They're not talking about bringing their troops, but have African troops on the ground doing that work against their own people. Neocolonialism. We say that one of the fundamental issues or the obstacle to the advancement of the African people today, as relates to this year's African Liberation Day, we say is the intelligential neocolonialists is the fundamental issue and problem, and this is the manifestation of it. Anthony, can you talk a little bit about this question of the role of the neocolonialist intelligentsia as they face the major obstacle right now in terms of opposition to allowing the people to move forward?
Let's see. I mean, I think a careful analysis of if our recent history shows clear that that neocolonialism is the primary manifestation of imperialism that's impeding the African liberation movement today, and it's been intensifying ever since Africans remounted the resistance drive since FIFPAC to obtain general liberation and independence for Africa. Alongside that struggle, there was a small but influential class of Africans that did not want general liberation, but really wanted to be the new overseers of the plantation, so to speak. We've been battling this form of imperialism for about 50 years now. And Kwame Ture used to point out that the African bourgeoisie is the filthiest and most corrupt bourgeoisie in the world. And he pointed out that during his lifetime, there were more Mercedes-Benz in Africa than any place else in the world. And that the class struggle must be more ruthless than it has been in other revolutions. And history has borne that observation out.
In terms of when you talk about form, Brother Hackey, as a neocolonialist, we're not just talking about Africa. We're talking about all over the world. And that's including America. What are these so-called African males? What are these so-called African CEOs? What is this African president? Is it not another form of neocolonialism, Brother Hackey, and the Rodeo Plan?
It is an exact form of neocolonialism. Unfortunately, people have been miseducated not to see it as such. I think at some point on a pragmatic, rudimentary level, you have to ask yourself,
What is the benefit of having a black man or woman in a position of power if they refuse to do anything for humanity? Then what purpose do they serve? The response is the only purpose they serve is the interest of the system. Is the system diametrically opposed to the survival of African people? Hell yes. Then why would African people oversee a system which is dedicated to destruction of people who look just like them? This is the insanity of it all. And this whole question of class, see, one of the things is once you get people to start thinking, equating, you know, material things with who they are as a human being, once you equate things with your essence as a human being, then you're capable of doing almost anything. And one of the things they've been very, very good at, and capitalists have been very good at teaching people that without things, you're nothing as a human being. And so these people, in order to be someone, are going to carry out the same ruthless policies, the same destructive policies toward their people that the white people are willing to carry out. So we have to understand that, you know, when we talk about this peculiar phenomenon of colonialism, or we talk about this slave mentality, given the street vernacular, that we are very, very clear that in the context of America, these mayors, these governors, these presidents, these CEO heads don't give a damn about the mass African people suffering. They don't care. It's not their focus. Their focus is to obtain as much material gain as possible in order to be somebody. It's absurd. It's absurd. But people have been miseducated to believe that, in fact, that things do define you as a human being. If you have no things, then you know about it. If you have things, you're somebody. It's absurd. People are Christians. Christians who should know better, or religious people who should know better, also have internalized the same kind of mindset. And one of the things I remember talking to one brother, he was talking about being productive. And my response was, you know, what do you mean by being productive? The job, blah, you know. And I'm like, wait a minute. Because I don't have a good job, quote unquote, making lots of money. That means that somehow my essence is somehow less than someone who makes a lot of money. What creator are you talking about? What creator would sanction such nonsense in terms of, you know, how to define creation, which is based upon things? Historically, Jesus never says the more things you have, the more somebody you are. Prophet Muhammad never said the more things you have, the more somebody you are. You know, Judaism never said the more things you have, historical Judaism. I'm not talking about that Zionist crap. That the more things you have, the more somebody you are. These are man-made constructs. So our people are privileged to the same kind of confusion, and this is the thing that we have to understand. In terms of the divisions that exist in the community, that we have to clearly differentiate. Those Africans who have our best interests in mind versus those whose position is antagonistic to our interests. And at some point, those two interests are going to collide. And that's putting it frankly, it has to. Because no people can endure this kind of suffering forever. At some point, if it reaches the pinnacle and people are ready to respond, and the only thing what is needed is a more exact definition in terms of, you know, defining who's your enemy and who's your friend. So we have to have that in terms of waging the struggle.
I agree with that. I would add also is the fact that. You hit the nail on the head correctly, Haki. I would add that's part of the reason why there is an effort underway by certain neocolonial forces to revise the histories and accomplishments of some of our revolutionary leadership, like Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, and Kwame Ture.
All right. We're going to change the subject matter just a little bit. We only have a few minutes left. We're going to talk about an upcoming event in which we would like to encourage African people in general and people of goodwill to come out, support, and participate. We have coming up in Richmond, Virginia, Cuba's Appreciation Awareness Day. It will take place on Wednesday, August the 13th, 2014. It will be held at the Wesley Memorial United Methodist Church, located at 1720 McKenzieville Pike, Richmond, Virginia 23223. The theme of the program is Cuba Changes Realities and Understanding. The keynote speaker will be Alexandra V. Rodriguez Salazar. He's the Secretary of the Cuba Interest Section. Topic will be Getting to Know Cuba, a Friend, a Nation, a Friend, a Neighbor, and a Nation. This activity will take place from 5:30 to 8:30 p.m. There will be a diplomatic reception and program. We'd like to encourage all our listening audience, if they are in this area, in this region, it very rarely we get a chance to have a dialogue on Cuba and talk to first-hand sources. We'd like to encourage you to come out this Wednesday, April the 13th, from 5:30 to 8:30 at the Wesley Memorial United Methodist Church at 1720 Mechanical Turnpike, Richmond, Virginia, 23223. For more information, you can contact African Awareness Association at African_Awareness_Association@Yahoo, or you can call 804-644-5830 or 804-549-7492. We have a few minutes left. Let's talk a little bit about this upcoming event and why Africans should come out and what Cuba really means to the world and what the world means to Cuba. Brother Hackey, take a stab at that. Why should the African community support this program? And what does Cuba mean and has offered to the world at this point in time that we can benefit from?
I think, you know, that's the question. As the economic system unraveled globally, there has to be a new paradigm in terms of being able to provide for the people who shelter people. Cuba offers that paradigm in terms of a different way of seeing the world, a different way of seeing humanity. And so it's good for people to come out, an opportunity to run ideas, you know, test your ideas, any concern that you may have in terms of, how people organize, or even to the contrast with the system here. I mean, come on out, ask the question, because this is the time to learn and to grow, and so we encourage all people to come out and support the program, because it is unprecedented. It's the first probably in the South in terms of actually bringing, you know, progressive individuals down here to actually speak on very pertinent issues. So I encourage all people to come out and support the program.
Brother Anthony, why should people come out and support this program?
It gives them an opportunity to find out about Cuba for themselves. In other words, they have access to a primary source of information about what life is like for the Cuban people in general, and for the Africans in Cuba in particular, how that's changed since the revolution, and what changes still need to be made and are being made today, and also how much Cuba has helped African world since the revolution took place in 1959, and why it is so hated by the U.S. And I think, but the chance to find out, for the people to learn about Cuba for themselves, is a golden opportunity. And I would encourage Africans in the Richmond area to support the program and check it out if they can spare the time.
Brother Moses, why should we support this program? What does Cuba mean to us?
Yeah, well, anytime you can do anything for the Cuban government. The Cuban government is, unlike some other governments, it's a progressive government and a revolutionary government. And so anytime you can support the Cuban government, you should be doing it. Certainly we need to educate our people as to what's going on in Cuba and how we could emulate some of the things that are going on in Cuba if we just got our heads together and got that same mind that was in Fidel Castro, that the same man that was in Che Guevara being us, and let us be about getting this job done and getting this monkey off our back.
Okay, before we close, I would like to get each one of y'all make a brief statement, just a little bit brief statement, because one of the things we most definitely must come to QA as relates to the Cuban Five. Brother Hackey, if you can just say a few words about the Cuban Five, and we'll tell the people how they can get in contact and find out more information. Why should we help the Cuban Five?
You help those who help you. One of the things that Martin Luther King was fond of saying is, you know, justice anywhere is an injustice everywhere. And so, therefore, what happened to these brothers was an injustice. I mean, clearly, the potential of U.S. government to inflict harm on people is something that these, you know, spend their life, you know, fighting to make sure that their countrymen are not victimized. So this question in terms of justice and honesty are values worth standing up for. So brothers should, so people should want to see them five in terms of their endeavors.
Okay. Brother Anthony, why should we support people in five? Why do people must come to their aid? Particularly people
I think people must come to their aid because they're political prisoners, and they're suffering. They put their lives on the line to defend their country from the attacks of terrorists coming from inside the U.S. And for that, they should be supported and be freed, as should all of the political prisoners in the U.S. ultimately be freed.
And final thought from Brother Rob on the Cuban Five.
Yeah, definitely the Cuban Five are political prisoners dear to my heart, because the Cuban Five came here in nonviolent direct action, and gathered information and in a sober and minded and clear lines of demarcation, decent and in order, everything was done. And they end up in jail because the U.S. government is opposed to communism, is opposed to anything that's for independence, and that's why they're in jail. They're political prisoners. Like he said, a threat. Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. And we're supposed to be fighting the war on terrorism. And these people came here to stop terrorism. That they were the original war on terrorism. If there is a war on terrorism, they're the genuine war on terrorism. And until we free them and recognize them as political prisoners and the situation, the circumstances which put them in jail, we're just hypocrites in terms of this war on terrorism. We're the biggest terrorist organization on the planet, the U.S. government. And the Cuban Five, in the spirit of Chelsea Manning and Eric Snowden, are political prisoners, you know, pointing out injustice and inconsistency, whistleblowers.
Okay, on that note, we'd like to just again share with everyone that please, if you're in this region, come on out on Wednesday, August 13th. 2014, to the Cuba Appreciation Awareness Day in Richmond, Virginia, as we host a Cuban delegation, which will be held at Wesley Memorial United Methodist Church, 1720 Mechanicsville Pike, Richmond, Virginia 23223. The theme is Cuba, Changes, Realities, and Understanding. Keynote speaker will be Alexander V. Rodriguez Salazar. He's the second secretary of the Cuba Interest Section, and we want to get to know Cuba as a friend, a neighbor, and a nation. This event will be from 5:30 to 8:30. For more information, please call 804-644-5830, 804-549-7492, or go to the website of the African Awareness Association. That's www.AfricanAwarenessAssociation.webs.com. Until next time, we'd like to thank you for allowing us to come into your home and share information. We'd like to thank you for allowing us to come into your home of allowing us to not only have a dialogue with you, but to receive from you. Because as we often say, that without information, you cannot think, and without organization, you cannot think clearly. Please join the organization that's doing something to help the people and to help advance humanity. Until next time, you have been listening to Africa on the Move, and it's your host, Brother Africa, Let's grab always to go forward ever and backwards never. We'll see you next week, same time, same station. So we'll leave you with the ongoing sweet sound of Brother Bob Marley. Forward to Africa.
Of my single bed, we'll share.